Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for February 25th, 2011.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
People who had been bilingual have more reserve. They have more resources to continue functioning at a high level in spite of the disease progressing in their brains.
The same brain area that is activated by reading is activated when blind read Braille using their hands.
What seems to be happening is the immune system is sort of redeploying its defenses away from viruses, essentially, and toward bacteria and other kinds of big extracellular pathogens.
This week, the surprising relationship between bullying and popularity, and why social isolation could change how your genes function. But first, Suzanne Bard reports that being bilingual could actually help stave off Alzheimer's disease.
Speaking more than one language could delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease, according to a new study. Researchers at York University in Canada examined the records of 400 people diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Half of them were bilingual, and half spoke only one language. Research psychologist Ellen Bialystok says the bilinguals developed Alzheimer's an average of 4.5 years later than the monolinguals, suggesting that they can better cope with its cognitive impairments.
We don't believe that bilingualism prevents Alzheimer's disease. What we're saying is that if you have a compromising disease, like Alzheimer's disease, that begins to erode your cognitive abilities, people who had been bilingual have more reserve. They have more resources to continue functioning at a high level in spite of the disease progressing in their brains.
She says that's probably because the effort of speaking two languages requires the brain to work harder.
So not surprisingly, children who grow up with two languages in the home develop language differently than monolingual children. But what became very surprising was when we realized that they also developed certain cognitive abilities differently and usually better than monolingual children. Cognitive abilities that are what we call effortful. Effortful because you have to control attention to a specific target, not be distracted, shift back and forth. These are all the things that we do regularly. When we're driving down the highway, we have to focus on the road, not be distracted by the signs, monitor the instrument panel of the car, and somehow not get caught up in the conversation in the back seat. So the ability to pay attention to what you need to be paying attention to is part of a set of cognitive processes called the executive function. That's what bilingual children were developing earlier than monolingual children.
She adds that other studies have shown that in older adults without Alzheimer's, performance on cognitive tasks increases with each additional language they speak.
Thanks, Suzanne.
The nation believes that when I speak for them, and I can't speak.
The Academy Awards are this Sunday, and a movie called The King's Speech has been nominated for 12 Oscars. It's also raising awareness about stuttering. In the film, King George VI struggles to address his people because of a persistent stutter he developed as a small child. According to speech neurophysiologist Ann Smith of Purdue University, only about half of all children who develop a stutter continue to stutter later in life. Her team is trying to determine which factors are predictive of persistent stuttering.
We're seeing that the stuttering children are lagging the non-stuttering children in terms of their oral motor coordination for speech. So these stuttering kids, their speech is more inconsistent in terms of how their brain is controlling their articulators. Already by 4, it's different. We're hoping that we can come up with some relatively simple tests that are predictive of stuttering.
She says the research will be used to help identify which children should be targeted for speech therapy.
Typically, I think the parents tell the doctor, you know, the primary care physician or nurse practitioner, and they're typically told, don't worry about it. So that's why we're trying to get the word out more, and I'm really glad this movie came along. So parents who have children who are stuttering should get the child evaluated.
Next, Suzanne says a new study is calling into question conventional wisdom about the part of the brain that's used for reading.
You might think that normally sighted people and blind people use different parts of the brain to read, but a new study challenges that view. Hebrew University of Jerusalem neuroscientist Amir Amedi and his colleagues scanned the brains of blind people while they read Braille.
And we were interested to know if someone that never saw anything in his life and get the information using his hands would activate the touch centers of the brain, or would the activation go specifically to the visual word form area. And what we found was that we actually couldn't tell if it's a sighted that read by vision or it's a blind individual that is using his hands to read.
He says that reading is a recent phenomenon in evolutionary terms, so we haven't had time to evolve a specialized brain structure for it. Instead, we most likely co-opted a region of the brain that was previously used to make sense of patterns, both visual and tactile.
People used to call it the visual word form area because it was activated when we read using vision. But actually, maybe now we need to change the name of this area because it's also a tactile word form area, or, you know, a multisensory word form area.
He says the next step is to see whether people, blind or sighted, who have never read at all, rapidly start using this brain region when they learn to read.
Thanks, Suzanne. Social isolation can profoundly change how the immune system fights infection, according to a new study. UCLA School of Medicine genomics researcher Steve Cole and his colleagues looked at gene expression in older adults. They found that the immune cells of people who lacked a social network turn on different genes.
There seems to be this evolutionarily deeply programmed scheme in our genome to change the kind of antipathogen defenses that it's expressing as a function of social stress. And what seems to be happening is the immune system is sort of redeploying its defenses away from viruses, essentially, and toward bacteria and other kinds of big extracellular pathogens.
He says this makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. Our ancestors often died from bacterial infections after being wounded by predators or human enemies. But they were more likely to fend off such attacks if they banded together. On the other hand, being in a tight-knit social group exposed them to many viruses, so an immune system that shifted its response to contend with changing social conditions helped them survive.
What you're really talking about is a difference between a relatively high likelihood of exposure to viruses under the happy social world versus a comparatively higher exposure to bacterial pathogens under either the hostile social world or the sort of no social world when you're on your own.
He says the work will help researchers understand how to protect people from the physiological consequences of social stress and isolation. Next, bullying has attracted a lot of media attention lately, but it's hardly a new problem. Justin Warner reports on the surprising relationship between bullying and popularity in school.
If movies and TV are any indication, most people assume that school bullies tend to hang out with the so-called popular crowd. Now, a new study from the University of California at Davis backs this up to a point. Sociologists Robert Farris and Diane Felmley studied over 3,700 8th through 10th graders. Farris said they started just by asking everybody who their friends were. He and Felmley used that information to plot everyone on a complex social web with the most popular and well-connected kids at the center.
The closer they were to that core, the more aggressive they subsequently became. But there was an interesting exception to that. What we found was that the kids at the very, very top had aggression rates that were significantly lower than the kids just beneath them in the totem pole. It's an interesting reversal, and the kids at the very top are actually expected to be among the least aggressive kids in the school.
Farris suspects that the most popular kids have little to gain from bullying and might avoid it because it makes them look insecure. In fact, although second-tier social climbers tended to become more aggressive, the aggression didn't actually make them more popular. Farris also notes that the majority of kids aren't actually aggressive, and that convincing these bystanders to stick up for the victims may be the best way to rein in the culture of bullying.
Thanks, Justin. Well, that's all we have for you this week. Next week, scientists have discovered a chemical signal that sends male squids into a fighting frenzy, and a listener wants to know if some fruit seeds really contain cyanide. Until then, tune into the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, we'll send you a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.